think we're going to win 2-1. I think the U.S. is going to win. It'll be a really tight game towards the end. It's going to be nerve-wracking.
I think we have a really good shot. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a draw and maybe even goes to penalties. And then it's anybody's game.
On paper, if you look at the individuals, Belgium would definitely win. But they haven't really played too well as a team. And I'm going to go for a 1-0 U.S. win. Hopefully.
U.S. soccer fans in Brazil staying optimistic about today's big match against Belgium. It's on everyone's mind. Kickoff is right after our show at 1 o'clock, so get ready for that. But first, we are going to get a preview with Graham Parker, who writes about soccer for the U.S. Bureau of the English newspaper, The Guardian. Welcome.
Hi, glad to be here.
Well, as we just heard in that clip, Belgium is the favorite. But, you know, the U.S. has surprised a lot of people by making it even out of the so-called group of death, beating Ghana, tying with Portugal, losing by just a goal to the Germans. So how would you rate the U.S. team going into the match today?
I think they're a very organized side, and I think that they have a lot of individuals on their team who work well together. And I think that becomes really important in tournament play. We've already seen a lot of teams with very talented individuals who you'd expect to dominate actually slipping out of the tournament because they don't quite gel in the way that the U.S. have.
And Jozy Altidore will be back. He is considered the strongest striker on the U.S. team, and he had to withdraw because he injured his hamstring in the opening game against Ghana. So what do you think about that? What does that mean for the U.S.?
It changes the shape of the team, obviously. I think Altidore was a very important player because he stretches opposing defenses. He makes space for the players who are in behind him. And he was a big problem when he went out in the first game. But the U.S. adjusted pretty well. I think Clint Dempsey came in and did a very good job against Portugal and a perfectly fine one against Germany. So I think that actually the way that the formation has worked out is probably going to be something that Klinsmann might well stick with from the start.
That's the coach that has made a lot of controversial calls. But how do you think that he has been doing so far?
I like him as a coach. I think that he's a great motivator, which he always did get credit for. But I think also he's underestimated and undervalued sometimes as a tactical thinker and about seeing the potential in certain types of players and the way that they work together. And actually, with players like Kyle Beckerman, who he brought into the midfield, that's a player who probably wouldn't have gotten near the side several months ago. But Klinsmann liked the way he played. He liked the way he fitted with the team. And he's very symptomatic of how this team operates.
Now, he has said that he is suspicious that one of the referees is could be siding with the Belgians because he speaks French and might be giving them an unfair advantage.
Well, I think that if you want to kind of dive into and unravel every episode of European colonial history, you could be spending a long time discussing all the permutations at this World Cup. So I think that might be a little bit of gamesmanship from Klinsmann, just perhaps keeping the referee honest, if you like, and certainly perhaps hoping that maybe a call will go his way. Just to show he's not biased.
Right. The referee is Algerian. Okay, tell us about the yellow card situation. And this is somewhat confusing, but as I understand it, in a game, two yellow cards equal a red card, meaning you're out of the game and your team has to play short a player. Yellow cards, though, build up over the tournament. And so where is the U.S. and its yellow card situation?
The principal two players who I would be worried about for the U.S. today who are carrying yellow cards into the game are Kyle Beckerman and Jermaine Jones. So Jones, Beckerman, Bradley are the kind of central engine of the United States midfield. A lot of play comes through them, whether it's in attack or whether it's in defense. And both Beckerman and Jones, if they were to pick up a yellow card today and the U.S. were to advance, they would miss the quarterfinal. So that's one to keep an eye on.
Okay. So there was a game earlier today, Argentina over Switzerland, beat them in overtime 1-0. So that means if the U.S. wins, the U.S. will play Argentina. So what do you make of that?
Well, I think that it's one of those World Cup storylines that everybody is following is Lionel Messi, who's the Argentinian talisman. Is he going to have the breakout World Cup that he has sort of constantly promised, or his talent has constantly promised? And he did make the goal today when Argentina had been playing very poorly and didn't look like they were going to score. But in fact, that's been the story of the World Cup so far. Argentina have not been that impressive, despite being one of the favorites. They've relied very heavily on Messi, who's not a bad person to rely on, of course. But they won't necessarily daunt whoever wins this afternoon's game.
Okay, so tell us more about the Belgian team and how they play their games and who are the strongest players.
They have a wonderful collection of individual players. They developed a youth system over the last decade that's really bearing fruit now. A lot of their young players are playing all over the continent in Europe in top leagues. So I think Romelu Lukaku, who's up front, is a big striker, and he's somebody to be wary of. He just came off a very good season. Eden Hazard is a very tricky forward as well, going wide. And basically, you could run through the entire lineup and say, oh, there's a recognizable name, there's a recognizable name. But again, they've won their group and they got maximum points coming out of their group, but they weren't that convincing in doing so. So it's certainly not a foregone conclusion that Belgium is going through.
Now, you're saying that they built up their youth soccer, and I think that's happening here in the United States. And, you know, ever since Pelé came to the New York Cosmos back in 1975, people have been saying, oh, soccer's going to catch on in the United States as a major sport. And, you know, a lot of people are caught up right now in the World Cup, have World Cup fever. And do you think that that's going to last once all the matches are done?
It won't last at the same level, of course. I mean, World Cups are high water marks. I mean, just like Olympic Games are high water marks for interest in track and field and things like that. But what happens is you do begin to attract more fans. You begin to get a higher profile of players begin to build up. The domestic game does begin to grow and solidify. And also, what's really been happening over the past couple of years is TV networks in particular are really jostling for position to make sure that as the game does grow, they're in the best possible place. So they've been buying up rights kind of left, right, and center.
Okay, so there are three quarterfinals now set. Tell us about those.
So, well, we have Brazil, Colombia on Friday, which kind of promises to be yet another incredibly emotional occasion. Because I just you've watched the Brazilian national team and you just watch the crowds and they're swept up with what seems to be as much sort of traumatic mood as celebratory as they go through those games. And Colombia have a very exciting young team. Jaime Rodriguez as their number 10 is a fantastic player, scored a wonderful goal in the second round game against Uruguay. And Brazil, again, not that impressive. And Colombia will be a real handful for them. I think that The game between Netherlands and Costa Rica has a regional interest for those of us who follow CONCACAF, which is the federation that the United States play in. And Costa Rica have surprised everybody in this tournament. And the Netherlands, again, they struggled a little to get past Mexico and were a little lucky that the Mexicans rather retreated into defense. So that's going to be yet another fascinating game and a lot of attacking play in that one. And then the big European powerhouses of Germany and France, both of whom have looked pretty impressive so far, France in particular, although Germany really struggled to get past Algeria themselves. And in fact, that's really been the story of the second round, is even the big teams just aren't having it all their own way in this tournament. So the tournament is wide open still.
Okay, really exciting. And T-minus 50 or so minutes from now, we'll see the U.S. game against Belgium. Graham Parker of The Guardian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, are you going to be watching that game, maybe with your coworkers, or are you just sick of all this World Cup talk and you just want to get some work done? You can call us, leave us a voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or leave a comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. All right, we know you'll be tuning in for the game right after the show, but elsewhere in the TV world, it's all about departures. Michael Schneider is executive editor for TV Guide magazine and co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff, and we started off by talking about a culling of view hosts.
It's a bloodbath over there.
It is. So there's one person now as host.
Whoopi Goldberg is the last woman standing at The View. So we're a little surprised to see Sherry Shepherd go. She was renegotiating her contract. They couldn't come to terms, so she's out. And then, of course, Jenny McCarthy, who was always kind of polarizing, because of her stance on vaccinations. There was always sort of an element of the audience just not really embracing her the way they have past hosts.
And this is the type of thing she would say about that topic.
Without a doubt in my mind, I believe vaccinations triggered Evan's autism. So I think they need to wake up and stop hurting our kids.
Okay, so why was she hired? I mean, her views are extremely controversial and discounted by all of science, pretty much. So was it just a stunt?
Well, I mean, they've had controversial hosts in the past. Elizabeth Hasselbeck, of course, went on to Fox News. She had very right-leaning stances on a lot of topics, was very controversial. Rosie O'Donnell had very controversial stances on the left. So they've always embraced controversial hosts. But Jenny McCarthy didn't have much beyond that. She's a decent host. She's been hosting for years. We remember her on Singled Out, the MTV game show in the 90s. So, she's a legitimate choice, but I think the audience just didn't quite embrace her. And that show's in the middle of a lot of changes with Barbara Walters, who, of course, founded the show, leaving. There's been a lot of upheaval for a while, so I think they felt the time was right to really just blow it up and start over again. And, hey, Whoopi Goldberg can now get vaccinated.
Exactly. Do we know who's going to replace any of these former viewers?
There are a lot of rumors. There's talk of, what they need to do is bring in more millennial, more younger hosts. So I think we'll see some younger folks. And there's also talk of bringing in some men, which would be a big departure for all of these shows. Ross Matthews, who had a show on E! And who people kind of remember as the intern on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno back in the day, has been talked up as a potential choice. But it sounds like they're really going to blow up the format.
Okay, another departure. Diane Sawyer announced last week that she would be leaving her post as anchor of World News on ABC. David Muir is stepping in. He's younger and he's white and he's a man. And so that leaves a white man as host of all three.
Same as it ever was, right? I mean, there was a nice break where suddenly we had Katie Couric come in. We had Diane Sawyer. It seemed like there was real diversity coming to the evening newscasts. But it's sort of back to what it used to be. But then again, the evening newscasts aren't what they used to be. There's just not the kind of pull that there once was. And you saw what happened at ABC. The lead anchor at ABC is actually George Stephanopoulos, who is the anchor on Good Morning America. He's not even doing the evening newscast because that's sort of where the money is now. That's where all the attention is. We're all talking about Today versus Good Morning America. We're not talking about NBC Nightly News versus ABC World News. It's just people are watching those newscasts, but not like they used to, and they just don't have the pull that they once did.
And they're not attracting young and diverse people anyway, so I guess it doesn't even matter.
No, I guess they've decided that that's just the audience, is that older white male.
They're just going to double down,
see the commercials,
triple down on that.
It's all pharmaceuticals at 6:30.
All right, more departures. The Leftovers, that's HBO's show that is about the rapture.
Yeah, or a rapture-like event, they like to say, because it's not the Christian definition of the rapture.
Right.
It's sort of a mystery on who was decided to leave. 2% of the population disappears. It's, of course, based on the Tom Perrotta book of the same name. So 2% of the population disappears, and the rest of it's 3 years later, and the rest of the population that was left behind are sort of, trying to get back to their everyday life. But there's obviously that sort of big mystery hanging over them. What did happen? What does it all mean? And what's next?
Okay. It debuted on Sunday, and let's hear a little bit from the trailer.
It's time again for the world to mourn the departed.
Disappearance of 2% of the world's population.
None of them are coming back.
Yeah, probably not.
So many of our loved ones were lost 3 years ago. We still wonder where they went and why.
Is this getting good reviews?
Yeah, it's actually getting great reviews for the most part. I think what we're going to find is that it's going to be a polarizing show. There are some people who just probably aren't going to be into it because it is a challenging show. And if you watch the first episode, some of it didn't quite make sense yet. You really have to, I think, stick with it to sort of figure out where they're going and what all these characters mean. And it's a beautiful show. It's an interesting show. It's not probably for everyone, but if you stick with it, I think you're going to be rewarded.
One of the co-creators is Damon Lindelof from Lost.
Yes.
And so is it Lost-like?
I guess you could sort of draw some comparisons. First off, there's a mystery attached to what happened to these people who disappeared. And so there, people are always going to draw parallels. And of course, then they're going to ask the next question, which is, well, I wasn't satisfied with the Lost ending. So is the Leftovers going to deliver, or are they going to leave us hanging as well? Now, I'm a Lost apologist. I love Lost, and I even was fine with the finale. So I'm probably not the best person to ask. But, you know, that's a question people are going to ask.
Are you a Whovian? That's my question for you.
I can appreciate Doctor Who. I haven't been a regular Doctor Who viewer, although, like everyone else, I sort of jumped on board and watched a lot of the Matt Smith years.
Mm-hmm. These are the later years. Talking about Doctor Who is a show that's been on the air for decades.
Decades, since the
60s. Gone through various iterations, the lead character.
Yeah. There have been several Doctors, and now we're about to visit the new Doctor, Peter Capaldi.
Okay, let's hear a little teaser from BBC.
Clara, be my pal. Tell me, am I a good man?
I don't think I know who the Doctor is anymore.
Okay, well, we do know who the Doctor is, and he is 51-year-old Peter Capaldi, as you said, and a departure from the kind of hunkier, younger Doctor Who's.
The last few have been slightly younger, Matt Smith being the youngest, and he sort of brought a fresh look to Doctor Who and brought in a whole new audience, including a lot of young females who liked how he looked. So this is, in some ways, a return to the original form of Doctor Who. Doctor Who, the Doctor on the show, for the most part, was an older British gentleman. Peter Capaldi is a fan favorite because he's a lifelong Doctor Who fan. There's a famous letter that he wrote to a BBC publication back in the 70s, I believe, when he was a young chap, sort of discussing the show. So he's a lifelong fan, and now to actually become the Doctor on the show is sort of an amazing turn of events.
I'm wondering.
He's come full circle.
Yeah. So he's a fan, and now he is the Doctor, and so his life stream has
and
been.
And he's a fantastic
achieved.
Actor. He's a character actor. So when you see him, you'll recognize him, but you probably don't recognize the name. So this is an opportunity for him to really become well known in the U.S. But then again, it's kind of a return to the original Doctor Who form. So we'll see if it actually has the same kind of resonance with audiences that
Matt
Smith years did.
Especially the young female fans.
Yeah, exactly.
Take to him?
We're not sure. And just got word that the show's not going to be at Comic-Con, which would have been a perfect place to introduce the new generation of Doctor. So we'll see.
Okay, the show debuts here in the U.S. in August. Michael Schneider, executive editor for TV Guide magazine, co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, a brand new California law says disability insurance must cover severe mental illness. What that means for people who might find it difficult to fight for benefits, that's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A bunch of laws went into effect in California today, including a new minimum wage requirement and a plastic bag ban for small stores. Another new law that's getting less attention will affect benefits for the mentally ill. It says that if you're in the business of providing disability insurance, you have to provide it for people with schizophrenia and other serious mental illnesses. Of course, navigating the insurance system can be Kafkaesque, even if you are not suffering from a mental illness. And that's why there are organizations like Mental Health Advocacy Services Los Angeles. It provides free legal services to people with mental and developmental disabilities. James Price is the executive director. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Well, what problem does this law solve?
This particular law focuses on disability income insurance that is short-term for less than 2 years. And the role of disability income insurance is when a worker gets disabled for a short period of time and needs to take time off of work, they are able to get paid their wages through the disability insurance and then allows them to return back to work. In the past, prior to this law, there was permitted exclusions for disabilities related to severe mental illnesses, so that if somebody with a mental illness was working and needed to take extra time off of work, there was no ability to cover that extra time off of work with the insurance policy. And so the person with a disability either had the choice of working through against their doctor's advice through the acute disability period, or to lose their job. And so what this law does is it brings mental disability into parity with other physical disabilities as it relates to short-term disability income insurance.
Which mental illnesses does it cover?
It covers severe mental illnesses that have already been designated to be covered in health insurance by prior California legislation, and includes schizophrenia and schizoaffective disorder, bipolar disorder, major depression, panic disorder, and up to nine different specific disorders that are included.
And do insurance companies generally push back harder on mental health claims than on physical health claims?
The answer is traditionally insurance companies were often unwilling to cover mental health issues because they were harder to figure out exactly how much they would cost, and they were harder to prove. And so there's been attempts in the insurance industry for the last 10, 15 years to develop what is called parity in mental health coverage of by insurance companies, where mental illnesses are covered in parity with physical health. That means that you get equal types of benefits for mental illness as you would for physical illness.
But I can imagine it might be more difficult for someone with a severe mental illness to navigate this insurance bureaucracy and to be able to fight back when denied a claim.
Absolutely. So there's really two different kinds of discrimination going on. One is the discrimination in coverage, which the parity attacks directly. The other is the need to accommodate people who otherwise would have a very difficult time making use of the various processes and procedures in place that would ensure that they get the coverage they're entitled to. And so somebody with a mental disability would, in fact, have a hard time potentially even signing up for insurance if they were not given the information in a way that would be useful to them. And certainly in the public insurance area, where we do a lot of work in our office, getting SSI and Medi-Cal, the bureaucratic processes are somewhat unforgiving and require a lot of accommodation for somebody who otherwise is entitled to the service but can't get through the sort of maze of bureaucracy.
Right. So they definitely need help in doing that, in navigating the maze.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so I'm wondering how often these claims actually end up being being fought in litigation, how often insurance companies are sued by people seeking benefits for mental illness.
I think that the lawsuits related to benefits from mental illness more often have to do with the coverage parity issue than they do with the access issue. Mm-hmm. And so there have been a significant number of lawsuits around parity, and particularly in health insurance. And there have been some very significant successes in the last year or so, where the issues of parity in California have really been developed so that one particular issue was whether residential care was covered for people who had a anorexia nervosa, which is one of the covered disabilities, eating disorder, and they needed to be in a residential program. The insurance company claimed that they didn't offer residential treatment for physical health care, so they didn't have to offer it for the mental health care, even though that was what was necessary. And the courts were very clear that, no, they do have to offer it, because even though it's not exactly the same as in physical health care, what you're entitled to under the parity laws is, in fact, care that would provide equivalent response to your medical necessity and may be effective. And so you get equivalent level of effectiveness. And so that required the insurance companies to cover types of services that were not otherwise on their policy. And when you have that kind of a situation, you have insurance companies getting very nervous about, you know, what else might be covered. And so there is a lot of resistance from the insurance industry to providing what's necessary for somebody with a severe mental illness.
So was there a lot of resistance to this law on the part of the insurance industry?
This particular law, AB 402, that went into effect today, relates to to a much smaller area of insurance, which is just disability income insurance, which is not the same as health insurance. That's just the income that is made up, makes up for your lost wages while you're out on short-term disability. And so there really was not significant opposition to this change in the law. I think looking at the legislative record, there was no official opposition to the legislation, and it was passed with a very large majority vote.
So what is the biggest obstacle that you're facing when it comes to getting people insured?
So, again, focusing on medical health insurance, some of the biggest obstacles are that in addition to the fact that many people who have serious mental illnesses lack the income to afford private insurance, and they do qualify for Medi-Cal in California, which is part of the federal Medicaid program. And in the past, the obstacle was in order to get Medi-Cal, you had to prove a disability, and there were lots of barriers in the process of proving disability. Somebody with a mental illness often had a difficult time documenting, collecting their records and documenting their history of treatment, and would go through the process and ultimately be turned down because they have a flat failure to document that process. Or failure to document their treatment, even though they had been in treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Today, there's been an expansion of the Medi-Cal that's available to individuals, and you no longer have to prove disability. Under the Affordable Care Act, California is one of the states that chose to expand Medi-Cal, and there's been a huge expansion of individuals applying for Medi-Cal who don't have to prove they're disabled. They just have to show they have no income or very low income. The barrier there is...
All right, we're going to have to run there. I'm so sorry, but we're out of time. James Price, Executive Director of Mental Health Advocacy Services in Los Angeles. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melanie.
And have you or someone you know with a mental illness struggled with the insurance bureaucracy? You can give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Leave us a comment, and we might use it at the end of the show. Coming up, the origins of today's crisis in Iraq and Syria can be traced to two men 100 years ago who drew up the modern borders in the Middle East. We'll talk about why it might be futile to try to preserve those borders after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A deal to form a new government in Iraq collapsed today. Meanwhile, the Sunni militant group ISIS declared over the weekend that Iraq is now a caliphate, an Islamic state ruled over by a supreme religious leader. The upshot, an Iraq in turmoil along with Syria and threatening the stability of the entire region. This unrest, this power struggle did not happen overnight or even over the last decade. Its origins were sown at least 100 years ago when the modern Middle East borders were drawn. James Galvin is in studio with us now. He's history professor at UCLA and author of The Modern Middle East, A History. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And we need that history of the modern Middle East because we maybe in the media have been getting it wrong. There are a lot of stories out now that Mark Sykes and Georges Picot from France and Britain 100 years ago, 1916, drew up the modern borders of the Middle East.
Well, that's not exactly true. I mean, first of all, when we talk about the Middle East, we're talking about an area that's much wider than what these guys were concerned with. I mean, for example, Egypt was there as an entity. Turkey became an entity as a war of national liberation. Saudi Arabia was through conquest, et cetera. But we are talking about that region that stretches from the Mediterranean through Iraq. And it's true that Sykes and Picot, during the war, tried to create zones of indirect and direct rule. But by the end of the war, the region...
World War I.
World War I. Mm-hmm. by the end of the war, the region was in such a mess. The Allies had promised, for example, certain territories 3, 4, 5 times to each other. There were a whole new dispensation. The Russians were out of the war. The Americans were in the war. The Americans were now in the peace settlement, et cetera. So they had to sit down at Versailles to figure out what sort of settlement they would reach. And the present borders started there and then emerged from there, from the negotiations mainly between the French and the British over what were called mandates. In other words, these were temporary colonies that were established in the area of what today consists of Syria and Lebanon, Palestine, Israel, Jordan, and Iraq. And the various powers, France got, for example, the mandate for Lebanon and Syria, or the territory that would become Lebanon and Syria. Britain got the rest. The powers had the ability to draw lines, to create boundaries, to take territories, put them together, to take them apart. One of the most famous stories about this is a story that came out of the Cairo Conference of 1921, where Jordan was invented. Winston Churchill was in charge of drawing the boundaries of Jordan. And, you know, Churchill, he enjoys his brandy and mm-hmm. his mutton and his big lunches and stuff like that. And so he was going to draw the boundary of Jordan, the eastern boundary of Jordan, and he took a straight edge and he put it down on a piece of paper. And he took a pen and began tracing the straight edge, and he hiccuped. And there was an indentation. And then he went back to the straight edge. And on a map of Jordan to this very day, you see an area that Jordanians themselves call Churchill's Hiccup. Churchill claims to have invented Jordan on one Sunday afternoon with a stroke of a pen, and it's perfectly true.
And therein we can see the problems and the roots of today's conflict all over the Middle East. But there is something to the fact that these colonial powers, France and Britain at the time, they in essence went back on their promise to the popular uprisings back then against the Ottoman Empire, and who they believed, the local populations believed, that they would indeed gain independence 100 years ago, and indeed they did not.
As a matter of fact, according to the League of Nations, Article 22 of the Charter of the League of Nations, the particular peoples of the region were to have first dibs on deciding where they wanted to go and who they wanted to belong to, if anybody. So there was a General Syrian Congress that was held in 1919 where you had representatives from all over what was called Greater Syria. And they met and they said, okay, look, this is what we want. We want complete independence and unity for Syria, which consists of what is today Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Palestine, Israel. If we can't have complete independence, we want an American mandate. If we can't have an American mandate, we'll take a British mandate. And under no circumstances will we accept a French mandate. Hmm. Guess who got the mandate for Syria and Lebanon?
The French got that mandate. And so, but you see the roots of nationalism there in the struggle against these colonial powers. And these struggles are continuing today, as we've seen in the Arab Spring.
Yes, but the nationalism in the region goes back much further than that. It goes back to the way in which the Ottomans, for example, promised certain civic rights to its populations. And those populations took them up on the offer and began organizing themselves in those terms. But I wouldn't put everything on the boundaries and the problems that we have on the boundaries, because I think that's taking sectarianism and ethnicity too seriously. Mm. In other words, these boundaries, of course, are artificial. But they've held, and they've held for a long period of time. And one thing that we've learned from the Arab Spring is that Tunisians fought against a Tunisian autocrat. They were very sympathetic to what was going on in Egypt. The Egyptians were very sympathetic to what was going on in Yemen. But nobody was advocating sort of the merger of these states as had been done, for example, in 1958. That these states now are fairly stable as entities, as for a variety of reasons, some of them because of a history of state building, for example, in particular Tunisia and Egypt, some of them because the international powers will not allow them to, even if they do fragment on the inside, will keep them alive on paper. And that's Syria and Yemen, for example, that will be maintained as independent states, even if they end up like Somalia.
But when you're talking about these states that have been maintained, and I want to take Iraq as a particular example, weren't they maintained because they were being maintained underneath the brutal fist of a tyrant and a dictator? And that had that dictator not maintained these borders, they would have collapsed along sectarian lines.
Well, that brutal dictator took power in 1979, and there was an Iraq a long time before that. Iraq was one of the first was the first mandated power state to receive its independence in 1932. So there was a long period of time in which there developed an Iraqi nationalism, and an Iraqi nationalism that included a variety of groups that we now would split up into various sects. It included the Kurds, for example. It included Sunnis. It included Shiis, and included Jews as well.
All right. So let's fast forward to now and what's happening in Iraq. And how seriously do you take ISIS and its call for a caliphate and how that's going to affect Iraq?
Well, tomorrow I'm going to proclaim myself Pope.
Okay, so I see where you're going with this.
I don't take it extremely seriously. There is a lot of problems with the way ISIS has structured itself, with what it's done. It's painted a big bullseye on its back right now, that ISIS itself is extraordinarily unpopular wherever it has taken power. It is fighting on multiple fronts now. It's fighting against, in Syria, for example, against the Free Syrian Army, against the Islamic Front, against Jabhat al-Nusra, a variety of other groups. It was able to take Mosul with 400 to 800 men simply because the Iraqi army melted away. That Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister of Iraq, is that unpopular that nobody is willing to fight and perhaps die for him. And they were also helped out by former Ba'athi officers who actually were the ones who probably organized the campaign and made it so effective. Now, how long is it going to be before the jailers and the jailed are going to split, are going to, you know, just come into conflict again? So basically, I don't take this extremely seriously, but by proclaiming himself a caliph, al-Baghdadi, I think, has made a tremendous mistake. This is a power play, obviously, against Al-Qaeda Central, but I'm not sure if any Muslims are taking him seriously in his terms.
But meanwhile, there's a very serious, maybe it's a civil war by now, war situation happening in Iraq and obviously also in Syria. And so, and today we saw the collapse of an attempt to form a new government in Iraq. Where do you see this headed in the short term?
Well, whereas I don't want your listeners to think of sectarianism as a de facto default position of Arabs or of Muslims, for example, I think that the ISIS strategy is to create sectarianism in the same way that political entrepreneurs have been pushing sectarianism, whether it's in the Balkans or in the Middle East, for years. And they do this in order to be able to mobilize their populations, create boundaries around their populations that they seek to mobilize and lead, and to just rev them up a bit. And ISIS is doing that right now in Iraq. And the problem is this. The problem is that they're getting a great deal of help from Nouri al-Maliki. And Nouri al-Maliki is immensely unpopular. He's created a split between Sunnis and Shiis by discriminating against Sunnis, by preventing them from participating in governance. People have not noticed, but since the beginning of the Arab uprisings in February and March of 2011, there's been equivalent uprisings taking place in Iraq. It's just that our attention has been focused elsewhere. And they culminated last year in an immense series of demonstrations that were put down brutally by Maliki with armed force. And same way that Gaddafi put down the demonstrations and or attempted to put down the demonstrations against him. So what we see now is a culmination of just bad governance and a political entrepreneur and a group of political entrepreneurs who are there to exploit the situation.
But the situation is that Nouri al-Maliki came to power when we took out Saddam Hussein, right? I mean, and so...
Dumb move.
Well, it was seen as here is a man who will finally represent the majority in Iraq and who will finally be the face of a new democracy. And it turned out the way it turned out. And so it does make one think, well, what happens? Why can't this happen in places like Iraq, in the Middle East, that there can be a viable power-sharing government?
We have one. We have an example of a very good one, Tunisia. in which the Ennahda, the ruling party, not only brought in two other parties into the government, but during a political crisis gave in on every question of the Constitution, stepped down from power, called for new elections, etc. So it's not a question of what's wrong with Middle Easterners. It's more of a question of the Middle East has been a battleground for has been a proxy battleground for many, many years now between the United States and the Soviet Union. Right now, it's between Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Iran. Excuse me. So what we see is a situation in which the foreign interference in large measure has prevented this from taking place, has prevented some transition from taking place. And we also see people who are out to exploit the situation of weak governments that have replaced former dictators, who also are exploiting the situation.
Right, right. Well, foreign interference that we were talking about that created this in the first place in creating these lines, these artificial lines. But I guess the question that I think a lot of people have, myself included, is that is it possible to have governments that do represent all these various groups, the Sunni, the Shia, the Kurds, all in Iraq, I'm talking about in particular, or if it is fundamentally impossible and that we should look at breaking up this country into three separate countries?
Well, there's a couple of points here. I mean, number one, people don't remember or don't know that approximately one-third of the marriages in Iraq are between Sunnis and Shiis. It's not a fundamental cleavage there in society. That the society itself is very heterogeneous, very mixed. So it's not a question of splitting it up into various points. But the problem is that once the Americans came in and set up a Shi-dominated government, majority-dominated government, they created a political sectarianism. In other words, there had to be guarantees that the minorities would be participating in the government. They created a Lebanon in mm-hmm. Iraq. In other words, in Lebanon, for example, every particular sect has a certain number of seats in parliament, has a certain number of cabinet positions, etc. You know, those are the guarantees that we're going to see that were there in Iraq. And if there's a negotiated settlement in Syria, we're going to see the exact same thing.
James Galvin, professor of history at UCLA and author of the book, The Modern Middle East, A History. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Barbara gave in to tell us what's happening at 1 o'clock. That does not involve the World Cup.
No, sadly. Hello, Madeline.
Hi.
Hello. We're talking about Iraq. We're talking about U.S. foreign policy. We're talking about
continuing the conversation.
Jets, yes. We will continue the conversation. An interesting counter viewpoint on ISIS and the appeal that it holds for Sunni.
Okay, we'll look forward to that at 1 o'clock. And to the point, Barbara Bogave filling in for Warren Olney. And coming up on this program, why, when we're not watching the World Cup or listening to the point, we're tuning into wildlife cams, 24-hour news feeds of animals not doing a lot of stuff. So what happened when the online viewer saw a baby eagle in distress? That story says a lot about how we view our connection to nature. That's coming up on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandwell. What's your go-to online distraction? Do you go to Facebook? Do you head over to Twitter, TMZ? What about wildlife cams? All over the world, hundreds of cameras are capturing bears, birds, fish in real time and streaming the footage online. And as you can imagine, not a lot happens very much or very quickly. But for some reason, many of us just can't stop watching. Well, recently, there was some action on the part of viewers of an eagle's nest in Minnesota. John Mualim is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, and he recently wrote about the Eagle Cam incident, and he's here now. Hi.
Hi.
Well, this all started with a bald eagle camera run by the Minnesota Non-Game Wildlife Program. And tell us about this feed and why it was so popular.
Yeah, this is a state agency that in Minnesota that has a camera set up at a bald eagle nest in an undisclosed location. They want to protect the birds. People had been tuning in ever since February, I think, when the pair of eagles had laid three eggs and then they'd watched the chicks hatch. This controversy all started in early May when one of the three chicks seemed to be wounded or hurt. It was immobilized at the nest and wasn't able to eat anymore.
So it wasn't able to eat, and people noticed that. And then what happened? They got really distressed?
Yeah, well, a lot of people started writing into the government and saying that they had named this chick Snap. It was the chicks they named were Snap, Crackle, and Pop. The government agency didn't name the chicks, but the fans of the camera had. And Snap was the one having all the trouble. So they started writing in and calling this Minnesota Non-Game Wildlife Program saying, you got to help this eagle. And, of course, the position of the agency was, we don't want to interfere in nature. We're giving you these cameras to kind of peek in on nature as it is. But in the end, they sort of had to cave to public pressure, and they tried to get in there and rescue the chick. Unfortunately, it was too late. The chick inevitably had to be put down, but people were still very grateful that they had kind of let it die in comfort.
Well, is that the issue then? Was it that people didn't want to watch it die, or people didn't want it to die?
I think it was a whole bunch of stuff mixed in together. I think there's definitely a lot of discomfort. But I also think people just become really attached to this bird, almost like a pet.
It makes me wonder, though, why officials put these wildlife cams up in the first place. So they want people to be interested in wildlife, and yet they don't want them to take too much of an interest, if you will.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the argument you hear is that these cameras are supposed to be a way for people to get interested in nature who ordinarily wouldn't, go out for a hike or go bird watching or something like this. It's a way to bring nature into our lives as we live them. And so that kind of assumes that we should be appreciating nature on its own terms. And what I sort of argue in the piece, though, is that, we've never really done that anyway. I mean, there was a time when the American government was killing off bald eagles because they were seen as pests, and then suddenly they were seen as victims, in the 60s and 70s of DDT and other pollutants. And so then we worked to save them and passed a whole bunch of laws to protect them. So we've always sort of stepped in when we felt like something needs our help, or when we don't want something in nature. We've always, we've never really had a problem manipulating nature to conform to our own, tastes. And I think what you could really see in this story of this bald eagle chick was that people were just deciding that the eagles were giving, them enjoyment by being on the camera. And there was really nothing wrong with stepping in to save this chick so that we could be pleased with what we saw on the screen.
And you say that there is a special repository for dead eagles now, that if you come across a dead eagle, you have to scoop it up and FedEx it to this place where they register it, and then the eagles can be used for Native American rituals.
Yeah, this was an example, I said, just as how much we sort of, manage and bald eagles or interfere with the lives of bald eagles. Even after they're dead, there's still a kind of bureaucratic protocol for them. You are supposed to find, if you find a target, you are supposed to sort of FedEx it off to the Federal Eagle Repository outside of Denver, where then, Native American groups who use these birds and bird feathers and for religious purposes or for ceremonies. There's a whole bunch of paperwork they have to fill out to request what kind of eagle parts they need, and then the repository ships those out from its inventory. So, to me, this was just like the most glaring example of how, to let nature run its course is sort of maybe an old-fashioned idea at this point, that we're even controlling the carcasses of eagles.
And is that where Snap ended up?
Yeah, that is where Snap ended up. He was shipped out just a few days before the piece ran.
What do you think it is about us that we are so attracted to watching what is, in essence, a kind of boring feed of animals doing their thing in their nests or what have you?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways it just shows, you know, that there is maybe an innate need in people for some kind of contact or exposure to nature, even if it's just, you know, virtually, even if it's just on a kind of adjacent browser window to your spreadsheet or whatever you're doing with your day at your office. But somehow these things just really can draw you in, even though, like you said, you know, oftentimes it's not the most exciting kind of footage you're watching. It's just, you know, a bunch of owls asleep in a nest. I think if you projected it on the wall of an art gallery or something, it, you know, it'd be one of these things that people praise for demanding a lot of its audience. You know, it's just sort of this like running nothingness a lot of the time.
It's the C-SPAN of nature.
Exactly, right. That's good, yeah.
John Mooallem, contributing writer for The New York Times Magazine. He's also author of the book Wild Ones, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people, looking at animals in America. John, thanks.
Thank you.
I have a Jolie Myers cam. When I get bored at work, I just look at it and it's doing interesting things. And here it is.
That's probably the creepiest thing anybody's ever said to me, Madeline.
That is really
However,
gross.
Yeah.
I just realized what that sounded like.
I mean,
like.
Better you than anybody else, I guess. At least the devil you know. So I was looking at a Shibu Inu puppy cam pretty much the whole time we were listening to it.
Really?
And I'm not alone. The live
stream. I don't
know
what a Shibu Inu is.
Puppies. They're adorable. They're these little puffballs that are just rolling around together. 64 million views.
Are you kidding?
So I'm not
You're
the
not
only
alone.
One not being productive. But as for the Eagle Cam, Gina Leslie left a comment on our Facebook page. Here's what she had to say. How disappointing that the organization bowed to public pressure and interfered with the Eagles. If you can't take the harshness of nature, then don't watch. When we mess with nature, we're missing the point of this kind of interaction entirely. Sit back, learn, and don't try to force human nature on eagles. Eyeballs this afternoon will not be on the Eagle cams, though. World Cup happening in 2.5 minutes.
I know.
Oh my god. If you work a 9-to-5, you may have to do some surreptitious watching from the office. Listener Pauline tweeted us. She said she streams the games on her iPhone, but apparently she's not the only one. She works with international students, and they're all peeping their phones under their desks at the same time. They're hiding it from each other.
Like
they should
a cam
just put it
on
up.
That. I just want to watch that.
Yeah, World Cup watching cam.
Yeah.
I think that that's a pretty good idea. I'll be there dancing in the front, Madeline, so you can turn off your work Jolie cam.
No, sorry about that. I'm officially on the creeper list. All right. Thank you, Jolie Myers.
You're
and
welcome.
If you want to send us a voicemail, you can 1-844 press play. You can tweet at us at KCRW press play. I am at the Mad Brand, and I have to get out of here now and turn on the World Cup. I mean, to the point with Barbara Bogave coming up at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.